Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to World Review from the New Statesman. It's Jeremy here, and we have a special episode for you this week. It was recorded last weekend, live in front of a digital audience at the Cambridge Literary Festival. And in it, Emily and I looked back at some of the predictions we made at the start of the year about 2021 in world affairs. Some listeners may remember we discussed some of them on the podcast at the time. And we looked at how those predictions are doing about a third of the way into the year. We also took questions from the audience on an array of international topics. Next week, we'll be back with a regular episode of World Review, in which we're going to be talking to the anthropologist Mukulika Banerjee of the London School of Economics about the ongoing COVID-19 surge in India, as well as Prime Minister Narendra Modi's handling of the crisis and the latest in Indian politics. So please do send us your You Ask Us questions on any of those subjects to podcasts@newstatesman.co.uk, and we'll try to answer them. We hope you enjoy this whistle-stop tour through the events of the year so far, and be assured that we're not copping out of rating our predictions at the end of the year. We will come back at the very end of 2021 for a comprehensive reckoning. Welcome, and thank you for joining us for this Cambridge Literary Festival event in association with the New Statesman magazine. I'm Jeremy Cliff, the international editor of the New Statesman, and I'm very pleased to be joined for this by our US editor in Washington, D.C., Emily Tamko. Thank you for being with us, Emily.
Thanks to the Cambridge Literary Festival for having both of us for this event.
How is the American capital this fine morning where you are?
We're thriving. There's a bit of a drizzle, but it's bright and sunny here in our hearts as we speak to all of you.
That's good to hear. Right. So in that positive spirit, I'm very pleased to say that this is the first live event associated with the New Statesman's World Review podcast, which is our global affairs podcast. And for those who haven't heard the podcast yet, the focus is really to get beyond the everyday events of world news, the headlines, and really explain what matters underneath the surface. What are the long-term trends? What does it all look like in context? And to that end, at the start of this year, at the start of 2021, Emily and I both put down some predictions about the year in world affairs and what would happen, partly to sort of stress test our own assumptions and analyses about the world, and also to ensure that our readers could hold us to account at the end of the year. And we promised that we would come back at the end of 2021 and see what we got right and what we got wrong. And when it was suggested that we did an event for the Cambridge Literary Festival associated with World Review, that felt like an obvious direction to go in. We're coming up to a third of the way through the year now. And so what better opportunity to check in on those predictions, see how they're faring, and also discuss a bit what's happening in world affairs in the rest of the year. But of course, an important part of the World Review podcast is also questions. Emily, what are we doing about questions?
Yes. So if you listen to the World Review, you know that we love listener questions. And as this is the podcast just live, we encourage you to send them in. If you're watching this on Vimeo, so there is a chat function. If you leave your questions on anything relevant to this podcast, anything from Russia to China to the EU to the climate crisis, send them our way. We will try to get through as many of them as we can.
Yeah. And you can leave them in there at any point during the conversation. So whenever something comes to mind, just drop it in there and we'll try and get to as many of them as possible by the end. So with that, let the journalistic accountability begin. And we've picked out a handful of the predictions that we made at the start of the year. We both made, I think I made 10, Emily made 7. And we're gonna try and get through maybe 4 or 5 of them and just see how they're doing. So number one, Emily Tamkin, at the start of the year, you predicted that the US will not achieve herd immunity through vaccination until late autumn at the earliest. And I picked this partly because it slightly tallies with one of mine. So I thought we could maybe try and do both of them, which was I predicted more broadly that we wouldn't look back on the year in December and say this was the year that normality returned after the pandemic. So I guess we can kind of put them together. But first of all, how do you think your prediction is faring?
Well, it's too early to say because the United States does not yet have herd immunity. And in fact, just late last week, it came out that the current rate of vaccination is not enough to achieve herd immunity, that we're getting to the point in the United States soon where supply is going to be greater than demand. Early on, there was a rush in many a state, particularly, you know, here in Washington, D.C., it was very difficult to get the vaccine. We're moving past that point now, right? We're moving to the point where we just opened it up to all adults. Any adult in the United States is now eligible for the vaccine. Essentially, what I'm saying is that we're getting to the point where the people who wanted to get vaccinated or who knew about vaccination or who were reached through the various outreach programs, those people are vaccinated now. So the challenge is, how do you reach people who either haven't heard or in harder to reach communities or who are vaccine skeptics? And I also want to note here that there was a lot written, including, you know, we also flagged this in our own reporting, that vaccine skepticism and hesitancy within communities of color who have been used, right, in some cases by the American scientific establishment. What we've actually seen is that the most vaccine hesitant communities are white religious conservatives. And it's frustrating, just as a person who lives in this country, that this basic thing that is going to keep not only these people, but other people healthy has become, like everything else here, a matter of partisan politics.
I mean, was your pessimism at the start of the year more to do with the uptake by Americans, so with regards to vaccine hesitancy, or was it more the logistical feat? Because watching the US from afar, I feel like there are moments when one is just sort of staggered at how dysfunctional the American state can be in the American political system. I mean, we've seen evidence of that this year as well, since we made our predictions. But there are other moments when you have to be incredibly admiring of the ability of America, despite its flaws, to get remarkable things done. And actually, I mean, it seems to me that the America's going quite fast on the vaccine front. In fact, I understand that you've overtaken the UK, which was previously one of the front runners. Biden's gradually made his own ambitions on this front more and more ambitious. Is there perhaps grounds for thinking that your prediction will prove too pessimistic?
No, I mean, in some ways, I'm always too pessimistic, and particularly was on this because, you know, Biden set this challenge for himself to get 100 million doses in 100 days. And it ended up being 200 million in his first 100 days. So yes, is the short answer, right? And to me, writing this at the beginning of the year, my skepticism and my pessimism and cynicism was tied up with the logistics. Firstly, because we had a president whose attention just was not on this. I gave the Trump administration credit in that Operation Warp Speed poured funding into the production of the vaccine and allowed them to—
Operation Warp Speed, just explain that for—
Operation Warp Speed being basically like the Trump administration's name for the program that was going to develop the vaccine and get us out of the pandemic. And they did. That funding allowed these companies to produce vaccine at scale, which normally they wouldn't have done at this early stage. But in terms of the, you know, they just weren't giving out vaccines fast enough. By their own admission, it wasn't happening. And so, you know, to have a president who's been focused on that, I think has made a huge difference. But even so, you know, there's the federal government, there's the state government, there's local governments. And I do think that you've still seen that dysfunction, as you said, play out in the vaccine rollout, particularly when demand was higher than supply, as opposed to this next phase that we're getting into. For example, it was allocated to every state by population, including Washington, D.C., which also had to vaccinate people who live in Maryland, Virginia, but work in DC, which is a tremendous number of people. So like 40% of DC's vaccines went to residents of Maryland, Virginia. This is one small example, but I do think it speaks to the ways in which just the structure of the United States made it the structure and size and the internal politics made it difficult to get this up and running. You predicted that the world as a whole would not go back to normal by the end of 2021. Do you think that we're on pace to see that dystopian vision become reality?
Part of my prediction was too optimistic, and part of it was too pessimistic. The part that was too pessimistic was I said that I thought, I mean, as I wrote that the 3rd or 4th or something of January, the UK had obviously started to emerge as a front runner, I think Israel too, but it was clear that a lot of countries were going to have real problems. And I think we were starting to see the beginnings of, for example, the slow vaccine rollout or the relatively slow vaccine rollout in the EU. And I just thought this is such an enormous logistical task. Western governments often overestimate their own logistical abilities. And this speaks to what you were just saying about the US. And I tended to think that there was perhaps a bit too much optimism. And I disagreed there with our colleague, international correspondent at the New Statesman, Ido Fock, who was actually quite bullish on the chances of the rich world getting vaccinated quite fast. And his argument was that, you know, there is just such a vast incentive for governments to get this right and to spend money, you know, large sums of money, because as he put it, it's going to be the biggest multiplier effect in history. You know, money spent on vaccines or speeding up vaccines can't really be excessive. So I think on that, I think Ido was right. And I think I was perhaps wrong. I mean, it's the success that we've seen in the UK and the way that that's driven down infection rates and the fact that the country's now been able to reopen, and particularly the success in Israel, the way that, you know, as far as I can tell, Israeli society has massively reopened and they haven't seen the infection rate go up. So I think perhaps I was too gloomy about the rich world. Where I think, if anything, I was too optimistic was on the poor world. I said I thought the fact that vaccines were going to be rolled out so slowly, the fact that you were going to have economic aftershocks would also contribute to the global south, for example, not returning to any sort of normality by the end of the year. And I think, if anything, that understated it. I mean, I'll give you two examples, Brazil and India. Now, these are both countries that were said around the start of the year or late last year, there was speculation that they'd even reached herd immunity. So Manaus, a city in the Brazilian Amazon, for example, was held up as a city that had a really bad first wave back last spring. But at that point, I think this was sort of late last year, infections were still very low. And, you know, there were serious analyses that said perhaps Manaus is the first place in the world that's achieved herd immunity. And we had a similar narrative in India around the start of this year. A lot of people had worried that India was going to have a very bad experience with COVID, but there we were, the numbers were quite low, the country had reopened. And in both cases, those optimistic assessments turned out to be wrong. I mean, Manaus turned out to be the hub of a new and even far worse wave of the pandemic in Brazil. Not only that, but it was also, it seems to have been the origin of the P1 Brazilian variant, which is a reminder of what happens when you have these concentrations of infections, particularly in poorer countries where it's more difficult for people to distance. And the same story in India, you know, absolutely horrific numbers out of India. The latest, I think yesterday, as we record this, 340,000 new infections in India yesterday. That was up on 332 the day before, 314 the day before. And each day now, India is setting a new record for the number of new infections in one country in one day. And that's before we get on to the long-term economic effects. And then on top of that, you know, nothing in the last few months has given me a great optimism that the world's poor will be vaccinated anytime soon. I mean, you know, there are parts of the world where I think we're talking more 23 or 24 than even 2022 as to when they'll get their jabs. Sub-Saharan Africa has had 6 million vaccinations out of a population of 1.1 billion. And so I think, as much as I think I underestimated how much the rich world might return to a sort of normal, and a lot of people in this audience will be in the UK, which is actually further down the road back to normal than a lot of countries, including Germany, where I currently am. But I think I underestimated how bad it was going to be for the global south.
But I think we should note that these two things, that they're connected, right? Like part of the reason it's as good as it is in the rich world is that that's where the resources are, right? Totally. You know, why does the United States have 200 million doses? And India can't get, well, it's because of patents and it's because of technically not export bans, but export bans, right? Like, we're doing so well. And as a result of that, other countries are not doing as well. And I think one thing we talked about throughout the course of this pandemic, and if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you will know this, we had sort of hoped that this would inspire world leaders to start thinking more multilaterally. Because as we saw from the outbreak of COVID, I don't mean like we're all in this together in a kind of, you know, children's TV show way. I mean, quite literally, that until this is, you can't eradicate this if it's only gone in the US and the UK and Israel. That's just not how it's going to go. I don't really think that was internalized.
It has to do with this term that I use, normality. You know, even if the rich world does get back to a recognizable everyday life, what sort of normality is it if it comes at the cost of this huge moral burden of having denied that the same normality to the rest of the world? And then even if you were looking at this from an incredibly selfish, self-interested point of view, as a resident of a rich country like you or me, you're still going to have knock-on effects from mm-hmm. a raging virus in the rest of the world. You know, as I mentioned, new variants that may or may not be resistant to some of the vaccines, travel will still be difficult. You're still going to have onerous quarantine requirements. You might even still have to have sort of occasional lockdowns to close down hotspots that emerge even within vaccinated populations. So I think we were both pessimistic, and I think there's probably grounds to say that we were both right to be pessimistic. Okay, let's have our second prediction.
Yes, our next prediction. Jeremy Cliff, At the start of this year, you predicted, quote, all regular U.S. troops gone from Afghanistan by the latter part of the year, end quote. Well, when you're right, you're right. So this was
actually, so far at least, it seems to have been a direct hit. 4 months is a long time in global affairs. And when I was writing this, because this was still quite an open question, Biden hadn't been inaugurated yet. This was still the dying days of the Trump administration. But it was obviously a big question that Biden was going to have to deal with soon. You know, Trump had presided over peace talks with the Taliban that had begun in Qatar in September. And under the terms of those talks, the US was meant to be out by the start of May this year. And so it was clear that Biden was going to have to make a choice quite soon after he became president. He didn't have any particularly good options. On the one hand, pull out and risk chaos returning to Afghanistan. On the other hand, stay in with a very small presence. I think there are about 2,500 US troops at the time that I made this prediction, which ran the risk that they were too few to be effective, but still 2,500 American troops in harm's way. Or do you escalate again and put more troops in, which seemed not really to be an option on the table politically. And I just thought that faced with three bad options, Biden would probably go for the one that would play best domestically. And, you know, getting out of Afghanistan is popular with the Trumpite right. You know this better than I do. It's popular with the left. It plays to this sense that of Biden trying to kind of disentangle the US from some parts of the world so that it can focus on, one, its domestic priorities, and two, the contest with China. And so I just thought that that added up to a decision where he'd say, yes, we'd leave. And lo and behold, last week he announced that the US would be out of Afghanistan by the very laden with symbolism date of the 11th of September, which will, of course, be the 20th anniversary of the September 11 attacks that sort of catalyzed the decision to go into Afghanistan. So that's my reaction to it. I suppose it did turn out to be accurate, but I'd really be keen to hear how you see this all from Washington. Did your expectations change soon after Biden became president? And I guess, secondly, where do you think this goes next? What do the next months look like?
Well, first of all, I'll believe that the troops are gone when they're actually gone. I just think that, you know, I was struck by the logic that he outlined in his announcement that the U.S. troops were leaving Afghanistan, which was basically that we've been there for 20, like, I was 11 when U.S. troops invaded Afghanistan. I'm not anywhere near 11 anymore. There are people fighting there who were not born yet when we went. I'll give him credit for saying there's never going to be a right time to leave. There are people in Afghanistan who are going to be hurt or die as a result of the United States withdrawing. But I think what Biden was basically saying was that we can't be here forever. I mean, that, and the argument that, oh, it's just conditions aren't right now. Well, when are conditions? I mean, as he said, we've given this argument time. We've given the argument that diplomacy without military support won't work. We've given it a decade. You know, I will say that the thing that I was less heartened by was this insistence by Biden that we were successful in Afghanistan. Yes. Osama bin Laden, who was sort of who was the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks, was killed 10 years ago in Pakistan. But if we were there to, you know, to root out the Taliban, well, the deal to leave Afghanistan was made with the Taliban, right? We're leaving starting on May 1st because that was the day by which U.S. troops were meant to be gone. I guess to me, the concerning thing is that this mentality of, and we're going to continue to fight terrorism all over the world, and we were successful here, and now we're going to leave to be successful elsewhere. I don't know that we as a country have fully grappled with the level of not success that was had here, right? And the lives lost, not just American lives, but the Afghan civilian lives that were lost as a result of this. And why did we fail? And what does it mean to fail? And what can we take from this so that we don't, not just don't make the same mistake, but don't make a new version of the same mistake? Yeah. And I guess that's what I don't see.
Presumably it's difficult politically for Biden to say this was not a successful operation, particularly judged in terms of the resources
politically, he's not going to come out and say, actually, we failed. This was a 20-year debacle. No. Sorry about all the money and your children's lives, right? He's not going to come out and say that. But I guess what I'm saying is that I don't know that we as a country are reckoning with what happened. And I don't know that we're leaving with enough humility, I guess, is what I'm saying.
I think it's a shame, you know, even if you, it's a shame if you simply think that whatever you want to call it, liberal interventionism is a bad idea generally, because it would make sense to acknowledge the failures in this case. And personally, I would like us more, and by us, I mean those in the UK and in Europe as well, to differentiate more between interventions that were that were badly thought out and on the wrong basis, like Iraq and Afghanistan, and interventions that did have positive, did have, you know, on balance positive effects, for example, in Rwanda or Kosovo in the 1990s. And I think it would help that differentiation if you'd say when interventions didn't work out, because I think it would give you more credibility to make the case for, say, this didn't work, but this will, and this is why this will be different from that, you know.
I also think that this is a challenge for progressives. And if you are listening to this or watching this, there is a good chance that you count yourself as one. You know, I think our refrain here in the United States is end endless war. That's one of the calls of progressive foreign policy at the moment. And I guess I just think that that in and of itself is not enough, right? Like, end endless war, okay, and then what? How are we, end endless war, and do you still concern yourself with human rights? And if so, how do you go about defending them and calling for them and improving your democracy at home while trying to support oppressed peoples abroad? You know, does end endless war mean you take your toys, you go home, and you just worry about your own? Because I think we haven't seen that work well either. And so I guess one thing that I hope will come from this is a conversation on and within the left about what a robust progressive foreign policy could look like, right? Like, okay, if we've ended this endless war, now what?
So, prediction three. Emily, you wrote in your predictions at the start of the year, tensions between India and China will escalate. And I think that was, if I remember correctly, that was a reference to partly to the skirmishes that took place in the Himalayas last summer, very concerning, between two nuclear-armed semi-superpowers. How do you think that prediction is looking now?
If one looks at it strictly in terms of the military, then obviously I was wrong, and that we haven't seen a return of that. But I think overall relations between India and China are not good. And I actually think that in addition to many things that the United States has done to try to bring India, to make India a closer partner, despite many decades of kind of skepticism and hesitancy, and the fact that the US, you know, the US likes all of its partners to sit at the same lunch table, and India for decades has gone by non-alignment or wants to continue its relationships with Russia and set its own foreign policy and not be a junior partner. You know, the US has worked to bridge that and to bring the United States and India closer together. As much as anything the United States has done, China's behavior has made that happen and has gotten India to more on board with the Quad, this partnership between India, the United States, Australia, and Japan, more comfortable with the concept of the Indo-Pacific, which at first it was really not, particularly because of Russia's hesitancy with this concept.
I think we should explain is this idea of a sort of alliance of powers in that region to counterbalance China. That's a fair summary, right?
Right, or a partnership, since India and the United States are not technically allies. But I will say that, and I wrote a piece on this last week, that to have a healthy relationship in foreign policy as in life, it can't really just be about one thing, right? Like if you both like cheese and have nothing else in common, that relationship's probably not going to last. Similarly, if all you have is that you both are working against China, it's a lot of pressure on this one part of the relationship.
I like this cheese as skepticism about China comparison.
Yes, thank you. And the other thing that I noted in that piece and we'll be writing on this week for the New Statesman, so stay tuned. I think that there's less, not I think, many people have said that there's less strategic empathy between India for the United States than there was for the Soviet Union, than there was for Russia, right? That they're less willing to overlook other grievances. You saw this when, you see this all the time, but India is much quicker to take umbrage, or at least the policy making class is quicker to take umbrage. Not necessarily people in government, right? But the media and strategists. And I just want to say that if the United States is not going to waive the patent for the vaccine because it's the right thing to do, they should absolutely do it because this is a major, this could be a major challenge to the idea that the United States is going to work with India to counter China. First of all, because if India is wiped out with, not wiped out with, but physically hurting and economically hurting and because of COVID, it's going to be a less helpful partner in countering China. But secondly, you know, if you're trying to get more of that strategic empathy, all these people dying and you having the thing, right, the intellectual property that could help stop it and not giving it, that will be remembered.
Yeah, I think that's going to become, the calls will only grow over the next weeks for a patent waiver. I mean, this touches a little bit on a related prediction that I made at the start of the year about relations between China and major democracies. And I said that I thought that they would deteriorate, But that efforts to coordinate those other democracies, those other China skeptic democracies, those other cheese lovers, to take on your comparison, that those efforts may not achieve very much nonetheless. And I think that actually the year has suggested that there was some truth to that, because there's evidence of a lot of countries, including treaty allies of the US and non-treaty allies like India, still to one extent or another hedging their bets on China. They may essentially tend to the American view, which is that China needs to be contained to some degree, might even potentially be a threat. But there, and there are various examples of this. I mean, look at, I think it was last week, for example, Emmanuel Macron and Angela Merkel had a three-way meeting with Xi Jinping to coordinate their positions on, admittedly, a policy climate where the world absolutely does need China, whether we want to, however closely we want to work with China or not, but ahead of Joe Biden's summit that he convened on that. And there was a slight sense of them sort of the three slightly undercutting Biden's initiative there. Mm-hmm. And I think that has to be seen in the context of the EU's decision to sign in principle an investment agreement with China right in the dying days, mm-hmm, of 2020, just before we first spoke about these predictions, just before the Biden administration came in and very much against its wishes. So there you have two countries that rely on the American security umbrella to a greater or lesser degree, are close political and diplomatic partners with the US, and nonetheless, were still to some extent hedging their bets. You even see it with the UK, which I think is even closer to the US on the big picture and how to regard China. But it surprised some people when recently the new British Integrated Review came out, which is supposed to be this big vision of Britain in the world, global Britain after Brexit. And a lot of people, including myself, had expected that would go very hard on the idea that the UK, that you couldn't get a cigarette paper between the UK and the US on China, that one of the UK's sort of USPs in the world would be as a sort of a European branch of American thinking on with regards to China. Mm-hmm. And actually, it was a surprisingly hedged document. And it talked about China as being a secure geopolitical risk, but it also talked about deepening economic relations with China. And these days, it's very hard to do that without it having some sort of geopolitical knock-on effect. And so there, too, you had an important ally hedging. And of course, it seems to be the biggest hedger of all among this supposedly China skeptic alliance, whatever we want to call it, is India itself. Mm-hmm. The country that is, in terms of weight in Asia, probably the most important, to possibly even more than Japan, to the US agenda on China. But where I think, it's very much kind of play it as it comes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that you'll know this better than I as an India watcher, but there's this phrase by Foreign Minister Jaishankar, India's on its own side. It's not on anyone else's side. And obviously, back decades in Indian foreign policy. But I mean, is India at all reliable to these sorts of efforts?
On the one hand, yes. On the other hand, the reality is that India is right there, right? Like the United States is many, many miles away from China, and India needs to sort of go along to get along with China. I mean, the other thing is that it needs to continue economic ties with China. People use Chinese-made cell phones, and it's still in some ways, it's not what we would call a rich country. And so for the United States to say, well, you have to end your economic ties with China to India, I think is a hard sell. I think it should not, personally, while it is predictable that it is as hard a sell as it is with the EU, I think that, to me, that's where the United States should be focusing its efforts, right? Not telling India, which can't necessarily afford to, cut ties with China economically, but the EU.
Yeah.
Which, and we talked about this on the podcast just 2 days ago, the United States tends to see economics and national security as being entwined, whereas Europeans, and we'll be hypocritical about it, right? But in their minds, in our minds, the two are linked.
I thought about that observation a lot since you made it on that podcast. It's such a good way of putting it, because it really captures a difference in how the US and the EU think about these things.
Thanks. I think especially Germany and France, right? We'll say, well, like, why can't we, why can't we trade with, it's like, well, you just said that they're the national security threat. So I think that will continue to be a point of tension between our great nations. Okay. You had another prediction, speaking of Europe, which was 2021 will in many ways be a more difficult year for the EU than 2020.
Okay. So I should give some context to this prediction. I was quite wary about making it, because I tend to think that particularly in the UK and to some extent the US press, the EU often gets written off or gets its obituaries written too soon. And we saw that in the Eurozone crisis. We saw that in the migrant crisis. We saw that with the rise of nationalist populism in Europe. And it's not to say that these weren't big problems and issues in Europe, but the EU did sort of muddle through and muddle on. And so when there was another wave of this early last year with the pandemic, my initial reaction was, I think this is people are again underestimating the durability of the EU. And I wrote that at the time in my New Statesman column, and that turned out to be right. You know, a few months later, the EU agreed a big, much bigger than expected, a support package for countries in economic trouble, 750 billion euros, backed by common debt, which is a big step forward, something a lot of people said never would happen. And I think that was proof that argument had been right, that you shouldn't sort of write the EU off. However, start of this year, I thought things could genuinely get very grim for the EU this year. At the point of writing the prediction, it was clear that the EU was falling behind on the vaccine front. You also have the fact that the big debates about the implementation of that 750 billion euros and eventually how it'll be paid for were yet to come up, and I thought they were going to be divisive. And then you had the fact that the economic shockwaves would nonetheless cause great suffering in European countries and potentially fuel the rise of anti-system and anti-EU parties. So that I thought that combination of factors that made me think that even as someone who's tended to try to be a bit more nuanced about the EU and its strengths and weaknesses, I thought that made for a difficult year coming up. And I'd say that predictions, I think some of that has proven correct and some of it, I think perhaps was a bit too pessimistic. The EU did struggle with vaccines in January and February, and it got pretty rough for the European Commission. Many blamed it for the slow rollout, including myself. I mean, it turns out that the EU had been much too naive about the way it had negotiated its vaccine deals and thought that it had room to bargain on price and had time to consult with member states, when really it should have been far more, the Commission really should have said to the member states, if you want us to negotiate this for you as a bloc, we need total carte blanche to negotiate as fast and as powerfully as we can. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't the case. But there have been some glints of positivity more recently. The vaccine rates have been picking up in most European countries, finally. Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, said just this week that she expected that the EU would hit its target of 70% of adults vaccinated in July, which is 2 months ahead of its own schedule. It's not as fast as the UK and the US, but not drastically behind either. There've also been, some would say, positive political developments in various countries. We had a Dutch election in March that saw the pro-European D66 party do quite well, which I think speaks to which might end up meaning that the most fiscally hawkish of the Eurozone countries ends up being more open to important discussions about reform. Broadly speaking, I think it's fair to say that the far right hasn't yet surged as a result of this. And where the far right is a significant player, for example, in France, there's a lot of questions as to whether Marine Le Pen could win the French presidential election next year. That even now, they're not saying we want to leave the EU. The idea of replicating Brexit with a Frexit or a Nexit or an Italexit or whatever you're calling it.
It's nuts it.
We need to work on that. That idea seems to have gone out the window. You have in Italy a new government led by Mario Draghi, the former president of the European Central Bank, who, whatever you think about him as a political leader, to the extent that he even is one, is a big player in Europe. The central bank governor who many say kind of saved the euro during the Eurozone crisis. And he's someone who can really, for once, as Italian prime minister, look the French president or the German chancellor in the eye. So that's good news. And then I think Germany, a bit like the Netherlands, is arguably shifting a bit towards a reformist position on the future of the EU. It looks like the Greens will probably be in the next government and might even lead the next government, as I've written recently. And I think that from a point of view that says the EU needs to go ahead and integrate in certain areas to act as one effectively, I think that's also good news. So a few rays of sunshine. It's still, I think, going to be a difficult year, but potentially not as grim a one as I'd thought earlier on, but we will see. So, I mean, just briefly from the US, is that the perspective, or is the EU still seen as a real problem case?
I don't think the EU is necessarily seen as a problem case in the United States. I think for one thing, we're so domestically focused this year, but I do think that, Biden's first foreign trip was announced, and it will be in the UK for the G7 and then to Brussels for NATO. And I think that's significant, both in terms of his relationship with the UK, but also in terms of his relationship with, he didn't have to go to Brussels for his first trip, and he did. I think that, you know, that China and Russia will continue to be points of friction between these two units. But I think that this team, this administration, is really committed to working with Europe.
Yeah. So we're getting some really good questions coming in. Keep them coming on anything we've discussed or other topics you want to hear from us on. But before we go to the questions, we have a quick fire round to keep us on our toes. So are you ready, Emily?
I'm ready.
What bad piece of news this year do you think is most significant?
I don't know if it's most significant, but a significant piece of news that we've not yet spoken of is what's happened to Alexei Navalny in Russia. Both the attempted poisoning, the return to Russia, and now, you know, the attempted poisoning was obviously not in 2021, but the return to Russia.
Fill us in on who he is for those who aren't.
Alexei Navalny is an opposition leader in Russia, or a prominent opposition figure. And he's, you know, he's gone through different phases, but I think the constant one can point to is that he's an anti-corruption activist, and for years was kind of left alone or not physically hurt by the Russian state. And then that changed. He was poisoned. His underwear was poisoned with Novichok, which is obviously highly, highly dangerous. He went to Germany for medical treatment and came back to Russia knowing full well what might happen to him. Indeed, that is what happened to him. He's now in prison. He's not getting proper medical care. He's been on a hunger strike. He may well die. And you don't poison someone's underwear because you're hoping that they'll live, right? So, and I guess the striking thing to me about this, well, two things. Firstly, he's in a very difficult position because too much Western support makes him look like a Western stooge, which is not necessarily helpful for him or for his cause. But on the other hand, there's not, you know, I agree with those who say that the US and its allies haven't called, you know, sufficiently for help. But the reality is that what we have seen is that there is not much that the US can do to change Russian behavior, right? The US has sanctioned Russia on everything from Ukraine to it's put sanctions on certain oligarchs who are ostensibly close to the Kremlin or thought to be close to the Kremlin. It put sanctions on over the poisoning of the Skripals in Salisbury. It's expelled diplomats. It's, you know, and it's not working. And so to me, there's the fate of this one man, which is important, but there's also the fact that I think what we've seen play out certainly in 2020 and now in 2021 is that the United States does not know how to get Russia to change its behavior.
Yeah.
What would you say is a piece of bad news?
A significant piece of bad news. We could debate how fundamental it is, but I think important because of what it means for the country in question, but also broader trends internationally, is the coup in Myanmar. That's certainly something we didn't see coming at the start of the year, but a military junta took power in the country in February. And I think it's significant, first of all, because there have been horrific clashes between the junta and protesters, pro-democracy protesters in Myanmar. It doesn't look like the junta will be overthrown or that democracy will be restored anytime soon. But I think for me, it sort of stands as a symbol of the struggles of democracy in the last few years. I mean, Myanmar was held up around the start of the last decade as a shining example of a country that had long had military rule and was trying to construct a democracy. It was a sort of an optimistic story. And Aung San Suu Kyi was, of course, a kind of an icon of that around that time. And the slide of Myanmar, first of all, with the violence against the Rohingyas, for example, but also the struggles to construct a lasting democracy, culminating in this military coup, I think is a sad story of a reversal of what something that was very positive and very hopeful. And, you know, you look internationally, democracy internationally is on the decline. Indexes of democracy, various organizations put them out, I think almost unanimously show that the number of countries, you know, graded by the quality of their democracy, overall democracy is declining. You know, you could look at examples like whether it's shifts in Russia recently, whether it's Hungary in the European Union, whether it's even actually flaws in the democracies of some very developed countries, including like the US, for example.
Including, say, mine.
Yeah, I mean, you're also looking at Brazil, some positive stories in Africa that have gone backwards the wrong way. And I think it just sort of, Myanmar therefore speaks for that kind of that negative trend in a very sad way. Okay, what is, do you think, A or the most significant piece of good news so far this year?
Well, this is great news that we just got recently, which is that we're maybe, hopefully, probably getting a malaria vaccine, which will be huge for the world, but specifically for Africa. Not to sound too, like, hippy-dippy about this, but I think that the overall good news story of the past year is science, right? Science working and people developing these vaccines, the COVID vaccine so rapidly, this malaria vaccine, just the fact that humans are capable of doing this and using it to help each other and ourselves, I think is incredible. I'm excited to see what the deployment of this vaccine will mean. And trust the science is kind of like a mocked cliche here in the United States, but I believe it. What is your piece of good news?
I will say, I think the malaria vaccine, of course, and just the fact that the COVID-19 vaccines do seem to work in the countries where they've been rolled out far enough, that is a positive that was less clear at the start of the year. But otherwise, it has to be the US returning to the Paris Agreement under Joe Biden. It's not enough in and of itself. And you and I have talked recently about the, you know, potentially Joe Biden's commitments on the climate not going far enough, certainly proportionally to America's wealth. But that was unequivocally a good thing. And I think it did set the world up for a genuinely open COP26 in Glasgow in November, which is going to be crucial. It's going to be when the Paris Agreement is going to be assessed, where countries will make new commitments. And I think without the US on board, that would have been extremely difficult. So I think that was a really good piece of news. So very quickly, before we come to questions, what will you be paying a particular attention to in global affairs for the rest of the year? What's particularly worth watching, do you think?
I think we've spoken a lot about it already, but I think this disparity between the rich world and the poor world and vaccine development and whether or rollout and whether or not the United States decides to help others as we have helped ourselves. It's the kind of thing where you can understand why they're doing it, right? Why they want to make sure that every American is vaccinated first. It's good politically, domestically. I just think it's truly short-sighted. Yeah. What story will you be watching?
Just various political stories very quickly. I think the Russian Duma elections in September are going to be interesting, particularly in the context of what you said about Navalny. It's pretty clear there'll be, it will be an unfair election, but it will still tell us a lot about the way that the direction that Putin's Russia is going in. I'll be paying attention to Brazilian politics because of the slide into authoritarianism under Jair Bolsonaro. Obviously, they've had a horrific COVID-19 pandemic. And they've got an election coming up next year, but I think we'll find out a lot about how that race is going to shape up. Luiz Inácio Lula is back on the scene, the country's former president, who some think could be a credible rival. And I'll be paying attention also to the German election in September. Obviously, a big one with Angela Merkel stepping down after 16 years. It's going to be genuinely open and competitive and will tell us a lot about the future of Europe. So I think that's something I'll be, of course, paying very close attention to. So that leaves us about 15 minutes to go through some questions. We have some really, really good ones. With no further ado, let's start with Millie asks, any thoughts on the clashes this week in East Jerusalem? Emily, I know you were watching that.
I think it's horrible, right? You have far right, essentially Jewish supremacists going through Jerusalem. The videos that made their way around on social media, you could hear Arab children crying. There were people hospitalized. And I think it's important to note, as others already have, that this is behavior that's emboldened by the government, right? By these far right and right wing parties. I don't have anything particularly profound to say about it other than that I think that, and I said this on the podcast on Friday, but that the politics of the street are emboldened by the politics of the state.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
just briefly, what do you think's the relationship with Israeli politics at the moment? Because on the podcast, we talked about the recent election and the rise of far-right forces also in Israeli politics.
I think there's a connection, right? If you have a political culture that is accepting of far-right parties and a status quo that just does not place value on Palestinian lives, then that also creates a culture of permissiveness towards violence against Palestinians.
Absolutely. Okay, Michael asks, this is a good one too, is geopolitics fragmenting or coalescing into big power groups again? And which, if either, would be better or worse? I'd like to have a swing at that one, but do you want to start it off? Okay, I'll take that. I think it is a bit of both. You are seeing big blocks emerge, and you're seeing that, for example, with the rise of the Quad, which Emily already mentioned, as an important format. This was a group of the US, Japan, Australia, and India that emerged actually in a quite ad hoc way to deal with the aftermath of the Indian Ocean tsunami as a sort of relief forum or a forum to organize relief. And it's turned into a significant coordinating organization for policy in the Indo-Pacific region. Now, for the reasons that we discussed earlier in this event, the extent to which you can expect different sorts of countries with different sorts of politics to cooperate on a particular issue, namely containing China in that region, is very much up for debate, but it is a thing. Similarly, I think the EU, for all of its flaws, and I think the fact that it's muddling through the current crisis, as I've said, still doesn't mean that it's performing at the best of its potential, but it is an important reference point. And I think, seen as I understand it from Washington, the EU is expected to do more in its own geopolitical neighborhood. I mean, I think we could perhaps leave the issue of Brexit out of it for now, but the thinking globally is, well, if there's chaos in Ukraine or Belarus or Syria or even in the Mediterranean, that's really the EU's job to sort out. I mean, in Latin America, there isn't currently a kind of a bloc type organization, but there is a strong sense that there should be one. And it is a live topic of political debate in places like Brazil or Argentina or Peru as to whether or not Latin America should operate more together. So I think you are seeing big blocs matter. But at the same time, I think for the reasons that we discussed when we were talking about India, China, and so forth, I think what you're more likely to see is blocks emerging around certain issues, blocks where countries are aligned. They might be, some might be democratic, some might be authoritarian. It might be a kind of a hard power subject or a kind of a geopolitical subject. It might be a values-based subject. The British government wants to expand the G7 into a D10, also including India, South Korea, and Australia. That's meant to be a group of countries that are similarly aligned on democracy. It might be a geographical bloc like the European Union. And so I think you will see more of a bloc-based system for the world. And I think that does, by the way, pose interesting questions for the UK as it sort of tries to find its place in this new world order. But I don't think you see, I don't expect to see that sort of crystallize into something like the Cold War. I mean, that term is still often used with regards to the US and China, the new Cold War, the Cold War between the US and China. And I think that's the wrong frame of reference. Mm-hmm. I don't think you're going to see those fixed monolithic blocks in a way that you did in the second half of the 20th century, but you'll see them, come together around certain issues, disagree on other issues, and then, reformulate on other topics separately from that. So that's how I see things developing. Emily, what about you?
No, I agree. I think in some ways the Cold War thinking is a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Because if you say that we're in a Cold War, it kind of reinforces these binary terms, and then that shapes geopolitics. But I really do think that it's more complicated than that. I mean, the European Union national security versus economics debate that we were discussing earlier is a great example of this. It's the same set of countries pursuing these different policies with China, like at the same time. And I tend to think, people in Washington love to talk about great power politics. And I just think that does not assign enough agency to, there's 196 countries to the other 194 other than the US and China.
It's interesting to see there's a lot of references at the moment, particularly in the kind of US foreign policy press, about the idea of a concert of powers. So something similar to what happened in Europe after the Napoleonic Wars, where you have a sort of steady alliance system. And I think that obviously appeals to a lot in Washington. I do wonder if that's the right historical parallel.
I mean, right, exactly. What comes next?
Yeah. It's interesting, and I'll follow the debate with interest, but I'm personally not totally convinced by that. But a very interesting question. Another question related to the US, or to the administration, what do you think the wider implications are of Biden acknowledging the Armenian genocide? That's a question from Stella.
It's a great question. I could be wrong on this, but I think, first of all, my own opinion, and this is only for myself, not the New Statesman, is that this should have been done a long time ago, and it wasn't because of relations with Turkey. So those who say, well, now it's only because relations with Turkey are bad, it's kind of like, okay, but we didn't call it a genocide before because relations were good or because we were trying to salvage them. So neither one of these is really a good reason to declare something or not declare something, in my opinion. The other thing is that, again, relations with Turkey are bad. So will this make them worse? I mean, maybe, but they're not, like, they're pretty bad now. Yes, Turkey is a NATO ally. Yes, the United States does need to continue to work with Turkey in some capacity. Is that reason enough to not call things by their own names, right? I personally don't think so. And I really don't think that we're going to, I mean, it would, I at this moment cannot imagine the kind of spiraling out of control that people are threatening over this.
Yeah. I think that actually speaks a little bit to the previous point we were discussing, in that what allegiance do the US and Western European or Central or Eastern European NATO powers owe to Turkey? On the one hand, it belongs to NATO as a bloc, as a military bloc. That is partly a legacy of the Cold War and is partly a relevant player in today's world. You know, whether you need to bundle in with that kind of total political alignment or diplomatic alignment even on subjects outside of NATO's remit, clearly not.
And also, I mean, this goes back to what we were just talking about, you know, there's been this idea that Biden will bring, potentially have a global democracy summit at some point, and that it'll be, we're going to have an alliance of democracies. First of all, I just think that opens up so many potential calls of hypocrisy. But second of all,
India is a case in point. You've written about the decline,
right. I mean,
the rise
India
of
worked,
nationalist authoritarianism. How on earth does Biden host Modi in Washington?
Right, as a sign of, as like the great democratic
democracy.
Alliance.
Yeah.
Yes. But I think it's also true for us. One thing the United States needs to get much, much better at is living by the words it says we live by. Practically, the US is going to continue to partner with Saudi Arabia and the UAE and Turkey, but that doesn't mean we need to pretend that things are not what they are.
Yeah, in fact, Saudi Arabia is a very good case in point. Okay, another question. What are your views on vaccine passports? I will take this one. I think, first, we have to separate vaccine passports used as passports to enter a country and passports used to go to the pub or something. I think with regards to the former definition, I think it's pretty much an inevitability. I think that the circumstances that we talked about at the top of this event in the first question or the first prediction, where you've got new variants emerging that may or may not be, which may or may not render vaccines ineffective, when you've got a pandemic continuing to rage around the world, when countries look to the examples of Taiwan or Australia or New Zealand, the countries that are generally perceived as having, best managed the crisis, and see that one of their main reasons for success is that they've controlled their borders in a very draconian way. I think all of those put together mean that vaccine passports for traveling from one country to another are more or less unavoidable. But then actually, I understand the controversy about vaccine passports within societies for doing things that, in your everyday life, but actually vaccines to travel from one place to another are not unheard of. You know, if you've ever tried to go to much of Africa, or if you've ever tried to get a visa for the US, you do need to get vaccines. Sometimes you have to, sometimes it's just recommended. So I don't know if it's, perhaps, I think some of the commentary slightly overblows how much that's a sea change from what we had before. What do you think, Emily?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think they're going to be required to travel internationally, and in fact, they are now. I think with all of this, it goes back to what we've been talking about throughout, which is that in the same way that the pandemic has exacerbated or made rendered more obvious inequities between rich countries and poor countries, this will too, right? Yep. So not only if you're in a, which is what, but that's what passports already are. You know what I mean? Like passports already serve to say, well, if you're American, you can travel to all these places without a visa. And if you're, I don't know, from name the country, it's much harder to travel to certain parts of the world. And so this will serve to underscore that. So I guess what I'm saying is my problem isn't with vaccine passports. It's with the rift between the global wealth and global poverty.
Indeed. Okay, with that, I think we're running out of time, unfortunately, for further questions. Thank you to everyone who submitted them. I'm glad we got through at least a good number of them. If you've enjoyed this conversation and are interested in some of the topics we've talked about, we'd strongly recommend you to read and ideally subscribe to The New Statesman. The New Statesman is covering international affairs even more now than it used to. We're putting a real focus on that. So I think all that remains is to say a big thank you to the Cambridge Literary Festival for hosting this event.
And to all of you for tuning in.
And to everyone watching this, thank you to you, Emily, for joining us from Washington at this so bright and early. Thank you to everyone who dialed into this event, and goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support The New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.